Man, I feel like I just browbeated you all there for like an
no,
hour.
No, it's good. It's good.
It's needed.
You're listening to The Great Game. This is episode 25. And in this conversation, Jack and I were lucky enough to sit down with two returning characters from the podcast. Zane from Very Large Huge Games, who we spoke to about First Contact and Aftermath late last year. And also Tony from Dukes of Highland, who we spoke to earlier this year about Gods of the Ancient World. In this episode, we really focused in on the art of publishing mega games. Not so much getting them from draft to design, but the practice of getting them out there into the world and in a state that other people can use. It's a conversation that I've had many times before, but not with people from the international community, and it is filled with insights. I think anyone who's interested in the backroom administration of mega games, or might have a game that they've designed or planning to design, and they'd like to know how to get it out there, I think this conversation is very fruitful, and hopefully you learn as much from it as I did. Enjoy. And here we are sitting down today, this morning or this evening, depending on who you are in this conversation. I'm here with Jack, I'm here with Zane, and I'm here with Tony, all regulars of the podcast. But for anyone who hasn't listened to previous episodes and heard your dulcet tones, Tony, did you want to start and just give us a little bit of an intro to who you are and where you fit in the mega game world, and also your experience with publishing mega games?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thanks for having me back. So I'm Tony Doherty. I run the Dukes of Highland. We are a mega gaming group based in Louisville, Kentucky. You can hear more about me and my background on a previous podcast where I talk about Gods of the Ancient World. That is a game that I designed from the ground up and have published it. And it's been on the market less than a year now, but as we'll get into later, I'm sure, I sort of designed it from the ground up and created the components with the purpose of publishing it. I've also published some murder mysteries and things too, but I don't think we'll be talking about those today.
Awesome. And Zane, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back yet again. Obviously chatted a few times about my game Aftermath and my involvement in First Contact. I sort of started my mega gaming quite a few years ago in Southampton in the UK, starting a group down here and started designing my own. And I wanted to get them out to other people. There were some mega games out there at the time, but I desperately wanted to get more out. So I was trying to get my games Infinite Horizon and Aftermath out there. Not really sold, just giving it away because I'm a terrible person to myself and just wanted people to have access to the games, either to run or to just rip off to inspire them to run their own games. But since then, I've been scolded and reminded that I should charge a very small fee and at least have some form of licensing agreement with them. So I'm trying to be more disciplined about that.
Awesome. And I guess obligatory mention as well. Anyone listening should know who you are, Jack, but you're also a mega game publisher. So did you want to quickly chime in on your background with publishing?
Absolutely, yes. So I have designed a couple of mega games, and one of them, God Emperor, I have published on DriveThruRPG.
And there is an entire episode of God Emperor in our back catalogue, which is the most listened to episode that we have. So
really? Wow, that's interesting.
I think it's because we talked about it for 2 years straight and then finally did an episode on it. Everyone just couldn't wait to find out about it. So I suppose I think we kind of touched on this in the intros, but maybe just jumping back to you, Tony, with what you said about publishing Gods of the Ancient World, what made you choose to publish the mega game, and when in the process did you decide to do that, and how did that sort of impact the process of designing it?
It was born of a frustration of people creating amazing games and then me not being able to play them. You know, the mega game hobby is an event hobby by definition. And therefore, if you are not in the region where the event is being put on, then you don't get to experience it. Simple as that. So, you know, I would listen to podcasts and that kind of stuff and listen to these amazing games and think, well, you know, I want to play them. I bought a couple of mid-game packages, found them slim because many designers, all the information that they have is sort of in their head, really, and is fine for when you're running it locally, wherever you are from. But unless you have that designer as a resource, then it's very difficult to put on. So, you know, I wanted to not only put on, you know, great events, but I also wanted other people to be able to do the same thing after my event was over. So it's not a money-making scheme. I know Zane's response made it sound like it was a money-making scheme. It's certainly not. It's just, you know, I want all that hard work that I put into it to be available to other people to use too and to be able to run great events as well.
Oh, I was definitely not implying it was money-making. It was more scolding myself for undervaluing work. And I think by publishing properly like yourself, you actually value it, and therefore it means mm-hmm. it's more value to other people. So now I'm it's the opposite. I am
okay.
I applaud maybe, what
maybe
you're
that's
doing.
Just like I took it. Yeah. Maybe that's on me.
And that being said, Zane, do you feel that does the value that you're giving the game and the design of it, the components, the way everything's laid out, do you think that that's changed now that you're going back and having a look at some of the games you've already got designed and figuring out how to, you know, polish them up for publication?
I did always want them for publication. After I did the first run of Aftermath, I did send it all to a group in Canada who ran it. And that highlighted some deficiencies in how accessible and usable it is. And Tony's talked about it definitely before in terms of the sort of the standards, and it was definitely, it's probably at silver, his definition. So not as bad down the list as some that are out there, but still, to me, it wouldn't have been enough if I had have bought it to run it myself. It would have needed someone to sort of rewrite it to understand what they needed to do to put it on. So going back, I have, since running the large version of it, I've used this and running it at UKGE as an excuse to sort of look at it again, work out where those gaps are, and try and write those other bits of documentation and just present it in a way that can be picked up. Print and play, I guess, that would probably be the right terminology. Is make all of our games print and play, so you've got all the documents that allow you to produce it, set it up, run it. It's a lot of work, and this is why I think, I'm sure we've said it many times on many podcasts, it's why so many don't get published, because actually it's a whole different skill set getting all of your stuff into a presentable format, getting all of those documents that actually explain what you need, how many components you need, rather than the designer themselves just sort of knowing off the top of their head, oh, I need 50 of these printed off, and they've never really written it down anywhere, or this is how I expect the table to be laid out, or whatever it happens, or even a guide to this is the expectation of how this game might be run, because you're there to talk it through. So, yeah, getting all of those documents in. And then just before the pandemic, I was hoping to run Infinite Horizon at Gen Con, and I also realised the cost of carrying all the components over may be not as effective as actually having them printed in America. So I thought, again, I needed to relook at all the rules and how it was presented. And so went back to it a few months ago. Someone inspired me to look at it again and realised I'd actually done quite a lot of the work to getting it ready to get back out there on the market. So, but it's a lot of work to go from just running a game to getting it into a position. I think this is where, as a community, we could probably help each other a bit more, because we all have different skills. And actually, you know, Tony's list of gold, silver, etc. helps. But someone needs to, there could be people out there that can actually help write some of those materials to fill those gaps of how to run a game.
Absolutely. It might be good, Tony, if you wanted to describe that rubric you've got of the gold, silver, and bronze standards for publishing?
Yeah, so in my day job, I am a data steward, which is a very not very interesting term for someone that just cares for data, I suppose. And at the company I work for, we have a rubric for managing data assets, so basically database tables and that kind of stuff. And based on how well you're maintaining that and how what the quality of that data looks like and what your documentation around that data looks like, we have this sort of bronze, silver, gold status for each, so that you know when you're playing with somebody else's data how complete it is and how much care they spend on it. So that's where I got the idea from, basically. And I use this, I put one together for a mega game package, I suppose, partly just for my own use, that I'm thinking of the things that have helped me in the past when I've run other people's games. So I've run Watch the Skies, and I've run Den of Wolves, and I'm going to be running Deep Haven here coming up soon. And so just harkening back to something that Zane said, not only did I use this package guide when I'm creating my own games, I'm also thinking about this same list of things when I'm running other people's games. And so my goal is any game that I get my hands on that I'm going to run, that I help them hit these same standards. So, you know, Trenton, who designed Deep Haven, has not put all the work into packaging it, but it's really close. And so as I am organizing his materials to run, I'm kind of going through the same checklist myself and helping, sort of providing advice to him and just doing some of the stuff myself, because it's helpful for my own run. Anyway, that's all an aside. I guess we can go through it. I've split it into three sections, a bronze, silver, and gold. It doesn't really matter that they're in three sections. I just think, like, what is a minimum requirement when you pick up a package of someone's, and what is, you know, the top tier? What are the really nice things to have? That's basically the way I've done this. So we can do it. We can talk through this in sections if you'd like, and then we can pause and we can look at individual things within that section. So for the bronze status, I have clear player instructions. I feel like is a minimum, because if the players don't understand, then, you know, you've just got no idea what you're letting yourself in for. So clear player instructions, easy to understand big picture theme overview. So as a game runner, the first thing I need to know is, you know, what's this game all about? You have a boilerplate, of course, which tells you a little bit about the game. But if I don't understand, like, how this game is supposed to function at a high level, there's no way I can run it. Like, I need to know that in Watch the Skies, the aliens are the story drivers, and they do things to the Earth, and then the Earth sort of responds to that. So that's the big core gameplay loop in Watch the Skies that is really important to know as a game runner. And then finally, a Mega Game 101 document. You know, what a Mega Game is, who control is, and what the in quotes goal of the game is. So for most people that's going to pick up a package, this stuff should be pretty obvious and self-explanatory. But not everybody. You know, there are people out there that want to get into the hobby for the first time that have never played a Mega Game because there's nothing nearby. And so they buy a copy of someone's game because they want to run it, but they're still not 100% certain what a Mega Game is. So I think we need to definitely include that as something for new runners.
I think that's something we can sort of already take from the community, because I think Becky and
absolutely
loads of others have already written guides that, and Jim and others, that we can sort of direct. I think that's probably the way for that, isn't it? Is to direct them to material that's already out there, but within the package.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm interested as well in that second point in the bronze regarding theme. I feel like that's from a lot of the games that I've read in the past, that's been a bit missing. It's more been like there's been a lot of information about upfront about the mechanisms of the game and what the players are doing and that kind of thing. But like you, the way that you described it with Watch the Skies, about what the theme is, what are the drivers of the narrative, what's the experience that players are meant to experience through the game. I think having that upfront can actually change hugely what people's interpretation of the rule books is, So I think that's, 100% support that being sort of the essential.
Absolutely. And I think, to me, these are really good things to keep in mind, even if you aren't planning to package it up or publish it. Like, having these three things in your rule set is just going to be really valuable in general, just for running it.
Yeah, me too. This isn't supposed to be something that's, like, totally out of the blue, right? This should be obvious. And if it's not obvious, it's only because you're in a bubble, right? You know, you're the designer, you've got this great game, you can explain it to people, but that's not to say that when you hand this over to someone, they're going to know really what you're talking about at a high level and what the core concepts are and that kind of stuff. So, we're all, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody here, we're all susceptible to this, so it helps to have these things sort of clearly defined and clearly written out.
Mm. Absolutely. So what have you got down for silver status, Tony?
So there are four things I have in here. The documentation includes a control guide, I think is vital, to tell you what the control is supposed to do, things to watch out for. The second point is control guide is per role, or certainly includes per role. So when I am splitting up my control team for a game, you have one person that's in charge of the map and one person that's in charge of the council. And so a control member, a volunteer that's coming to my game to help me run this game, doesn't want to know everything. They only want to know their piece. They don't care about the map if they're in the council. And so if you need to present your instructions to them and your training to them very specifically. All components ready to print. I have seen this before. It's driven me crazy that it's hard to work out like what you're supposed to be printing when you receive a package for the first time, or it's not in a format that's easy to print for whatever reason, or there's just documents missing. And then the final thing is an example room table chair setup. This is something I added recently because I'm going to be running It Belongs in a Museum and later this year, and I was talking to the guys, it's like, I don't really know what a room looks like because I've never played this game before. So I kind of threw something together and bounced it off them a couple of times, the designers. And in the end, I was like, tell me what an ideal room setup looks like. And because it's very different from reality, of course. They were like, well, we had a terrible room and we had these restrictions. It's like, I totally get that. But what would an ideal room setup look like? Just so I can understand, again, back to the flow of the game and the way that people move around the room and the way that the story changes between teams. So documentation with the control guide per role, components ready to print, and then the example room table chair setup.
I like the fact that you've included the table set up in the bronze one, because I think actually as designers sometimes people don't think about the flow of the game as much as they probably should, or maybe I think about it a lot, but I think the layout is almost not as important, but it's part of the way the room works and the story works, depending on who you're close to, where you're actually getting to, does actually impact who you're most speaking to, etc. in the game. So yeah, I think that's really good, Tony.
And the control team too. I for Deep Haven, a control member looks after two clans and a guild or two. So you've got to make sure that they're not running from one side of the room. They all need to be close to each other so that they can facilitate cleanly, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, a great example of something that's probably very clear to the designer, but when you're picking up a new game, you're like, where are all these people supposed to be? Where, like, very easy to, get misled there. Awesome, and gold status.
Yeah, this is a little larger, because these are the nice-to-haves, of course. But I still think that they should be in every game, because you want every game to be complete and easy to run. So the first thing is the production guide. I think this is absolutely vital, and I don't know how people cope without a production guide. Like, tells you the quantity of each component that you need. The fact that that's missing from packages is mind-boggling. Like, how do I know how many dice that you need to add stickers to, or how many cards do you need? You know, you've here's all the PDFs of the cards that need to get printed out, but you've not told me the quantities of them. Like, those things are super important. Quantity of each document required.
You've even put that in gold. I'd say that's sort of in silver. Like, how can you even produce your own game without that? Like, well, I don't think I could.
These aren't necessarily... they're more of a guideline.
Yes, yeah. I know. I'm just interjecting.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Quantity of each document required. So not as important, perhaps, because, you know, some people are very averse to printing out documentation. I actually like it because I can't guarantee that people are going to turn up on the day having read anything. I think we've talked about this before many times. Mm. But, you know, making sure you've got one copy of the rules on each table, that kind of stuff is helpful for me. Instructions on how to create components or examples of what to buy, I think, is really helpful. And where to buy them from. I listed Amazon links to the kind of things that I was buying. Of course, it's just a guideline for folks, and they don't all have access to the same Amazon that I do. But just to give you an idea of what it is I'm envisioning when I say foam board counters. What is a foam board counter? You know, some people just have no idea. So that's my production guide section. I'll just pause there a minute.
Yeah, I'd say I'd like to add something else to the gold one that I haven't seen, which is actually how do you deal with changing player numbers within that game? Because actually that's something everyone sort of assumes you'll be playing at an ideal number, but we all know we get dropouts, maybe you're not going to get up to full numbers. Some have it. I've definitely read some that have got a sort of, you know, you can run this at 30, 40, 50, 60, and these are the sort of roles. I think that might be something that probably be worth going in there, unless you imagine that's already part of one of the other documents.
In fact, Zane, I added that today. I was thinking the exact same thing. Like, I ran Den of Wolves last month, a couple of weeks ago, and we ran with 26. And so before the event, I had to think about which ships I wasn't going to be playing with, where I can trim people out of ships without, you know, without it being overwhelming for people. So I think that's super important too.
Yeah, there we are. You've already done it. Damn.
Just to share it with you guys.
I think in general, having a guide of how to tweak things or how to change things, if depending on the situation, is a really lovely thing to include.
Yeah, again, particularly if you're a new player or you've never seen this game run before, like, it's so hard to visualize what is mandatory and what is optional. So that kind of stuff is super helpful. And then the rest of these checkboxes I've got are information on when to release plot points, I think, should be part of the control guide. And again, this is the kind of stuff that's in the designer's head, and or a really experienced game runner will sort of instinctively know. But if you're a new game runner, you have no idea. Like, you're playing Den of Wolves. When is the right time to throw a pandemic into the mix? Or when does a ship arrive on the horizon that you've got to take care of? Those kind of things, I think, are helpful for new players and new game runners, excuse me. Control guide includes scenario planning for big outside-the-box ideas. This is me because I'm a little bit anal, but I like to... It's futile to try to predict the kind of crazy stuff that's going to happen in the game. Like, how I didn't predict that hole in Gods of the Ancient World when the Spartans wanted to create a hole, I don't know. But that should be something that I'm thinking about before the game appears, so that when the Spartans come to me and say, we want to create a hole that we can kick people into, I'm like, hey, that sounds like a great idea. I had never thought of this before. And then I run away and, you know, implement something that I've actually put thought into rather than try and come up with it on the fly.
I don't know how you didn't predict that hole either.
I don't know either. And then finally, and this one is probably a little controversial, but ways to contact the designer. Some people may not feel comfortable with that, giving that information out. I have no problem with it. Our community is small. Again, I want nothing but the best for game runners, and I want to be a resource for people that want to run my game. So I think it's important to be able to have that connection, that relationship with the person people that created the game in the first place.
Definitely. And the fact that we can communicate so much easier now. You know, I say it as if technology has jumped forward so far, but, you know, even back when I just started doing Watch the Skies as the first game, I don't actually know how many years ago, possibly even 10 years. Wow. 7, 8, I don't know. We didn't have platforms like Discord so easily to just jump on and talk to people. You know, you still had to use email and phone calls and things like that. And yeah, I know other things existed, but people weren't so comfortable just jumping on to speak. Whereas now that and so I use Miro board in a lot of training for facilitators and stuff like that. You can just jump on and run through an example with someone remotely. Which is a wonderful place to be. And I think, yeah, hopefully more of the designers are willing to do that. And I think most are, aren't they, Tony? Most are open.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so far my interaction with people whose games are not mine, they've been very keen. Zane, we had a chat just last week about a game. Kieran, who potentially will have been on the podcast at this point, or potentially is about to be, depending on when this goes live. He's the designer of the Generalissimo is Dead, and I've had a few chats with him about that game, which has been awesome. I was actually just going to shout out, Kieran was going to be in this discussion and wasn't able to make it, but just running through the list there, one thing that I've been really impressed by with his publication of the Generalissimo is Dead, hearkening back to having the components ready to print and having everything laid out and ready to use... in a well-organized way. Something that comes with his game package is that he did design that game just before the pandemic when everything had to go online. And so the final pack actually has two versions of the game. One has the assets for playing it online and one has the assets for playing it in person and sort of guides on how to do each. And I found that really, really helpful, even though I'm not planning to run it online. It's something that sort of... it's not necessary, but if your game is set up for that type of thing, it's something definitely worth considering and including in this day and age where everything, there's so much happening online in the mega game space.
Yeah, so we have to check my game against Tony's list when you've had another look at it. See what's missing. Let me know.
More than happy
I'm probably designer blind. Well, that that's something that happens. I think
we all
probably admit that, where you think you've done stuff, you think you've explained it, it's in your head, and it isn't until someone else points it out, it's completely missing, and you're like, in your head, it was definitely there. You definitely put it in the pack, but no, somehow it stuck out.
The room, the example room with a table and chair set up is a perfect example of that. I haven't published a game, but I've always put those in my packs. But it's such an easy thing not to, and it's such an easy thing also, I think, to be scared away from, because you don't want to confine people if you put in a really complex setup and say, this is exactly how the game needs to be run. You don't want people to feel like they can't run it because they can't satisfy that space. But it really is a helpful tool and something I reckon a lot of designers should be thinking about.
Absolutely. And it strikes me that I would say most of these things I feel like are easier to do right when you're putting the mega game together itself, rather than after you've run the mega game and then going back to your files and going, oh, hey, I need to get this together. I need to get these files together. Like, having this checklist in mind at least feels like the way to go if you are planning at some stage to release it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think just having decent folder structures and document records and things like that are just so key right from the outset. I guess that's where a little bit of like current job comes in, as I've been given the task of, in Britain we have something called BIM, which is Building Information Management for all our construction stuff, which is really about how keep complex documents and information together for very complex building structures. You know, millions of drawings, well, not millions, but hundreds of drawings and different revisions and stuff like that. And just making sure at the beginning and outset you structure your files, you structure your documents, you make sure you're doing your revisions properly, because it becomes, you don't think it's going to be hard, but it becomes very quick that actually things aren't filed properly. things aren't actually got the latest revision, you're suddenly, you know, using the wrong version of something, or you've saved the wrong version somewhere, and it can quite quickly spiral out. And then if you do want to publish it, you don't have all of the documents you need. So I think setting that up straight from the beginning is incredibly helpful to yourself. And there's probably something, Tony, that we could talk about maybe outside of this, is producing some template for people around production guides, stuff like that, because for some people that's huge. You know, it's different when it's, you know, document control and stuff like that. It sounds like me and Tony have some overlap there. It comes to you fairly naturally, whereas actually, if you've never worked in that kind of industry before or had to think about it, it might not be as simple. So it might be quite helpful to share sort of... It's everything about this community, isn't it? We like to share, but also not. It's a kind of a slight contradiction about the whole... People are a bit shy to share what they're doing. I guess, I don't know whether it's for whatever reason, whether it's, you know, fear of being criticised or fear of stuff being taken and used, I don't know. But we're not that great at just learning from each other, and we all have to sort of reinvent the wheel a little bit. You know, Tony, I think you've probably bought more, or all of you actually probably bought more games than I ever have. So my exposure is only really through asking other designers to give their stuff to me so I can look at it, or through playing games or running games. So I don't often see, you know, what they actually offer in the pack, because they just send me rule books and art and stuff like that. But just sharing sort of the way people set it up ready to publish, production lists, that kind of thing, I think would be really, really, really useful.
Yeah, and just, you know, something that is not on this list but probably should be is when you hand someone access to your shared Google Drive, whatever it is, that's got the documentation in it, you strip out all the crap that you don't want. You know, as a designer, you go through all kinds of iterations, and there's all sort of, you know, spreadsheets just packed full of data where you've been doing calculations on, you know, turn times and resource movement and that kind of stuff. And if you receive that as a game runner, you know, is it important? I don't know. If I touch it, are they going to get mad at me? You know, so stripping out the extra stuff, I think, is equally important when you're handing over your game to someone.
Absolutely, especially when your game has been through a lot of different versions, and, you know, that number of how much X thing costs, there's been like 5 different versions of that number. That is a huge step of going through and like, okay, what was the actual final thing we settled on? Let's get rid of all the old information. That's a big one, I think.
Mm-hmm. You don't need to keep it. It's okay. It's okay to clear things out.
Yeah. Deleting old versions and that kind of thing. I feel like hearkening back to what Zane was saying about sharing things in the community, it's almost as if we need... I think a lot of people going through the design process, they involve a lot of extra hands to review the iterations as it goes. And it's, you know, it's more like a playtesting review. It's almost like we need a publication review process in the community where things can go to others blind and they can run through it, not thinking about, is this a good game, or have I got ideas about the mechanics, but more just thinking, is this ready for someone to run, or are there big gaps? And that's a vulnerable process to go through, I suppose, for people if they haven't published before, because they could have a pack that is totally, you know, stuck in that phase where they know everything in their head. But feedback is valuable.
I think having that board would be amazing, but I think the reality is the most we can achieve right now is, as a game runner, if you're running someone else's game, you're doing that for them. Like I was telling you about Deep Haven, like I'm going through these steps for Deep Haven right now, and then at the end of it, I'm going to turn around and give it back to Trenton so he can, you know, publish it or not. Or, you know, at least he's got a game that is easier to run from then on, because he struggles too. You know, if he ran it before last year, he had run Deep Haven like in 2019 or something. So when we asked him to run Deep Haven in 2023, it took him ages to get back up to speed because it'd been so long sat in a dusty shelf somewhere. So having like the quantity of each component, that kind of stuff, is super helpful for the game runner themselves, even if you're not planning on publishing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're finding that with First Contact, rerunning it and slightly changing stuff every time. There's a little bit of cracks in our document control process, embarrassingly, which do make it harder. Had we been a bit tighter, then there wouldn't be those little... And they're fine, they're sorted out, but they make work where it's not needed, don't they? But going back to that sort of slightly bit about, you know, having peer review, I guess, I think that's probably why I've been too self-conscious to charge. It's not about not wanting to make money, it's more a fear that a product, I don't have a product that is in a good enough place to ask for money from someone, and that embarrassment for someone to not be able to just pick it up and run it.
I think we're very alike.
Throw it at people. Throw it at people instead and go on, run it, and then they can tell me what needs improving, and maybe at some point I'll properly put it out there rather than just stick it on, come and talk to me, you can have my product, but come and ask me for it first sort of places.
Mm, that's definitely where I'm at, Zane. I think that having that confidence that it's a robust product and it's you know, it's ready for someone to use in a happy way and for them not to get frustrated by everything that's missing or that's inconsistent, that kind of thing. So it sounds like that is part of the process, getting over that hump.
And another bit I think that's probably difficult and probably not talked about much is pricing, you know. Like, I don't know. I struggle to know what to charge. I don't really know what other designers, because we don't have like a website that says, you know, get these games for this much. A few people have it openly, but not many. How much is it worth? What is it worth? You know, Tony, you're buying games from others. You know, is there a price point that you think, well, that's a bit too much? Or is there an expectation if someone charges a certain amount, you should get a better product? You know, it's a small community. There aren't that many of us running these games. You know, we all want to, you know, a bit of reimbursement for all the time spent, the thousands of hours spent on designing and making it. But I don't know, are we comfortable as a community even sort of talking about what value it is? And Jack, yours is on...
Absolutely.
You put yours on drive-through, is it? So that must be...
Has
it got a price on drive-through?
It does. I was just going to ask this question about, I mean, let's imagine that you've followed all these steps, you've got a gold status mega game package. Where do you decide to put it and what price point do you decide to put it at? So for me, yeah, for drive-through, I put mine on drive-through RPG. It is, now I can't even remember, but it's a $30 basically. So very cheap. I did that because I guess I didn't feel like this was going to be a huge money-making endeavor in any case. I kind of set my price point was mostly fairly arbitrary because, like you say, it's very difficult to find other guidelines of what is the accepted going rate for this kind of thing. I think I would, DriveThruRPG is, it was useful because it is just an automated process, obviously. People can buy it whenever they want, and I can, and just contact me if they have any issues. It does mean that your game, if you do choose this, will be exposed to potentially quite a few people who've never heard of a mega game, so... you kind of need to go in knowing that. And yeah, after posting it on DriveThruRPG, I did get a few comments saying, what the heck is this? Like, and kind of not understanding what it was about, which was on me for not really explaining it well enough. But I think I would recommend it if you're interested in that kind of experience. You just have to know that a lot of people will buy it who... you don't know and don't have direct contact with. And I think a lot of designers obviously want more direct contact of knowing who is going to run their game more specifically. So it's definitely a more hands-off kind of approach. Tony, how did you decide to get your mega game out into the world?
I host the my package on my own website. Last year, I sort of upgraded my Squarespace to a professional platform so that I could sell. And not only am I selling my game there, I'm also selling my event tickets there as well. So I don't have to give a cut of my profits to, profits in quotes, to like Ticket Tailor or TicketBot or whatever it is. So it's all done on my Squarespace website. And it's priced at $200. So the reason for the location is because, one, I can do it. Two, if you want a mega game package, you're going to be specifically looking for it. At this stage of the hobby, you know, it's very niche, and I've used DriveThruRPG before for like murder mysteries and things, where I think that wider audience is a good thing. I don't think it's not somewhere I considered for a mega game package though, because like you said, you know, people don't know what it is. So that's why I hosted it on my own website. And then the reason for the price point is, you know, I just compared it to other games out there. You know, Den of Wolves is £200, which is like 280 American dollars. So I thought $200 was a reasonable price. You can't go so high that it's going to go beyond what people are going to make back from running the event. But also you want to get paid for your work, like we've talked about too. You know, I didn't knock my package together in 2 days. It took me like a year. So do I think it's worth $200? Absolutely. I think it's very, very cheap for what it is. But I also understand that someone that's running a game for the first time may not have a bunch of money in their pocket. You can break even from running your first game if you're lucky. And so it has to be reasonably priced. So somewhere between me wanting to make it a worthwhile product. I think if you price it higher too, it's got an indication that it's also of higher quality. There's a lot to be said for that too. This is my MBA talking.
I was going to agree with you there, you know, yes, from my business days and self-employment. Yeah, you've got to price it at a point that makes it of value, don't you? You can't sell it for £10 and people are not going to think it's actually worth anything.
I think $30 is an absolute steal. I think you're selling yourself short.
Everyone quickly go and get it. Go and buy it before he puts it up.
Well, it's probably worth mentioning. Yeah. So I did get, when I released it, I did get a lot of comments from people complaining the price was too high. Again, I think just because they didn't know what a mega game was or what the product really was, which, you know, is down to me maybe not explaining it on the storefront, but it is probably worth mentioning to people if you decide to go that route that you probably will get some of that kind of audience who don't know what the product is.
Mm. And I think with Kieran's publication on itch.io, he also encountered a few of those where there's sort of people jumping on. I don't remember what his price point was. I think it was similar to what you were saying, Tony, in a couple of hundred or maybe 150 for the Generalissimo is dead. But he was getting some comments on there, people saying, what the hell is this? This doesn't deserve to be this price. What is a mega game?
Right, blah, blah, blah.
People really fired up about not knowing what's going on.
Yeah. And then I guess I was just going to say, we also get Watch the Skies, I guess, down at, is it £40 at the moment or £50?
Right. It's Yeah, so I think a huge part of it is also the marketing part. So how are you sharing this product? How are you explaining what it is to people? What audiences are you putting in front of? Probably will impact as well what you're going to be able to sell it for and to whom.
Yeah, break even is very important when you're running, especially your first game. Mm. Because whilst I think a mega game ticket for an event is worth like $60, £50 or whatever, I don't think it's worth that much to someone that's never played a game before. So when I ran my first game, I charged $25 a ticket, which I thought was underselling it, but I also knew that it was a brand new audience. And so when you're considering what someone is going to do with your package, you are considering what it takes for them to break even. So you have to imagine that this is maybe the first game they're playing. the first game they want to run, what they're going to charge, and what break even looks like for them. So I also know that it's a reasonable player count for Gods of the Ancient World. It's 62 players, which is very different from a 30 player game that you can buy. And therefore your break even point is very different. So all those things you need to take into consideration when you're pricing your product.
And then of course that varies depending on where in the world people are doing things and for whom. So for example, here I've found venue costs in Sydney, at least, I think seem to be quite high comparative to other areas where people are running these games. And we only really get by now by breaking even, because we are in Sydney, we're a not-for-profit. So working with some of the councils here, we actually get 50% off venue hire. And that just lets us sort of scrape by keeping tickets at a reasonable price, which is about 40, usually it ends up being about $40-$45 here. So I guess geography comes into it as well, for what's going to be a break-even price for people in different communities.
Absolutely.
Zane, talking about the publishing route though, in the medium, how have you in the past published your games for distribution, and how do you plan to in the future?
So, I mean, originally they were just through our website at Diversionary Games, but that was it's a website we've not really kept up to date very well since we've sort of... I don't do much through that name anymore. I used to run games in my local city here in Southampton, but I haven't done anything for many years. So now it sort of gets hosted through, or diverted through, Mega Game Assembly's website. So that's where I've been sticking them. But as I said earlier, I haven't felt like I've had a product I'm willing to charge money for yet. So they've always been in the free to play site, with a sort of caveat of, here is the player's handbook, but come and ask me if you want to run it, which has driven quite a few people to it over the years. And it has been run, as I said, some of them in Canada and other places as well. So yeah, it's not the best strategy, but as Tony was saying, if people are looking to run a mega game, you know, they're Googling and looking for it. So it's sort of, they're not going and browsing randomly on drive-through or whatever. They are actually Googling or looking through Facebook or wherever else for how they can get hold of mega games. In the future, to be honest, I'll probably do the same, but I don't know, I might cheekily host them through our very large, huge game site rather than Diversionary Games, as we've updated Aftermath through that. Not sure about Infinite Horizons, that might stay independent, unless I can convince them to do a 200-player version of that, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. So I was keen to dive into the process of designing for publication a little bit, which I think we've covered in a bit of depth already. But I'm curious, maybe starting with you, Tony, the question is maybe a bit more about, now that you've done Gods of the Ancient World and published it, do you think that future game design, do you think you'll ever design a game not for publication? Or are you kind of just set in a single way of doing it now, and that's just going to be your best practice?
Well, the Mega Game package guide that I've put together is Bronze, Silver, Gold. I mean, it is a living document, right? Just on this call, I've already added something. So, but I use this same document for any game that I do. I don't, and therefore, if I'm organized when I'm designing a game or when I'm running someone else's game, hopefully I should be getting to pretty close to this list anyway. Perhaps not all the full control guide, but certainly some of the control guide, because I have to train my control team on some of these things that are going to come up. So I think if you're putting together a quality event, you need to do many of these things anyway. And if you want to run it more than once, I think, you know, components go home in people's pockets and you have to reprint some stuff, and or maybe you're adding extra teams or whatever it is. So you need to remember what you did the first time, and you do that by being organized and having all this stuff written down. So I don't think I'm stuck in a certain way. I think it's just being organized, and then because you're organized, you're 95% of the way to having a package that you're ready to deliver. All you have to do to get from A to B, at least for me, because this is just the way I am, is I take all my working documents and turn them into PDFs. I clean up my control guide and add in some links for examples of components. And the rest of it is already done. And then that is the package, and then you're ready to rock and roll. Why not put it on for sale so that someone else can run for it? Particularly as, you know, in this hobby, it seems like when you put on a really good event, the first thing I do is I throw pictures up online, I write an after-action report, I tell people about how great it was, because I want the hobby to get better and bigger, and I want to advertise for my next game. And so you do that with, that's just basic marketing. And so, you know, you have all this information, and then someone's going to, I'm going to get on a podcast called The Great Game, and they're going to ask me all about my game, and they're going to say, hey, oh man, I'd love to play that game in my town. How am I going to do that? It's like, hey, lucky for you, I've already packaged this up, and it's available here. So it all works together nicely if you can be super organized at the very beginning.
You're very optimistic about how many people listen to this, Tony.
I find if you just throw enough stuff, you just see what sticks.
For sure. That's something I think from my experience, and I mean it is limited from what I see from the different communities, but that marketing of games is not doesn't happen a lot. I think we're pretty good these days as a international community as a whole of marketing the events, but there's definitely not a lot of voices out there saying, hey, this is how you can get hold of this game, not in a really overt, open way. Even for the ones that you don't pay for, you know, the Mega Game Assembly, when they put together that page of all free Mega Games, there were so many there, and I think they're still being added, which I had no clue existed until they actually went to the effort to put them in one place. I think that's definitely something across the community that we could probably improve as far as sharing, getting the games out there. Zane, how do you think that this kind of conversation and some of the broader conversations going on now about how to publish games and what the standard should be, that kind of thing, has impacted how you intend to design games in future?
I mean, honestly, no, because I think I was sort of trying to do that anyway, if I'm honest. But I think it's important to have the conversations. I think there's probably, you know, similar to many other gamers, there's a difference between wanting to be organized and being organized, and many of us that are creative, our creativeness comes in splurges, and it's not always organized, and it's actually quite a lot of effort, even though my job means I have to audit other people's records and how good they're being and keep an eye on them. It doesn't mean that I do the same myself. So I think that gap between keeping good records right from the beginning and the willingness to do it and actually doing it are huge, especially, you know, when it's a single person trying to design and put on a mega game themselves. You know, we're getting a better community that's good at supporting each other, but it's still a lot of work and a lot of, I'm generalizing, aren't I? But, you know, I can only speak from my experience and some of those I've spoken to. You know, some of us are a bit closer to the bone than's probably comfortable, you know, getting stuff done. You know, there's the old saying for the UK thing that, you know, you're not doing a mega game unless you're up till 3 a.m. the night before the game still cutting components. And if you're doing that, you're not filing your stuff ready to be published the next day.
That is unbelievable. I've heard that before, and that drives me crazy.
Yeah,
I'm ready like 3 weeks out.
Ernie.
Yeah.
I know. I must be in a minority.
I sadly think you are.
Yeah. I think so too. But it's a minority. It's like an exclusive club that I think more of us need to get into. I think I've gotten better at that over the last few years, but there's still been a few of those. Not so much the night before, but definitely the week leading up, doing a bit of guillotining and that kind of thing. But keen to refine that, especially with running now that we're in Sydney, we're doing a lot more running the same game, which in the past, like for almost our whole existence, over 10 years, we've nearly only ever run a game once and then moved on. And now we're looking at running them more frequently, the same games. I'm interested, Zane. I think you're right that we probably have limited experience with it's just what we personally here have been exposed to. But I do tend to agree that I do think that a lot of people aren't thinking about this stuff when they sit down and want to design a Meggy game. I'm interested in the idea that most people that I've spoken to who have run have designed these games and then have got them out there, most of them do have a sort of corporate or career-related connection to the kind of skill set that you do. I mean, you don't need, but makes it handy to be able to do this kind of stuff as far as record management and editing and that kind of thing. So that's where I'm wondering if, as a whole community, we can start exploring a bit more how to outsource that and share that around, because it's not a skill set that everyone will have. But many more people than those who have that skill set have in them the skills needed to design a game. So we need to pair them up and start getting more games to a point where they can be shared.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if there was a, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but if there was a group of, I don't know, neutrally aligned people that were happy to be thrown a load of documents at and say, how far away is this from publishing? And, as you were saying earlier, I think you need to do this, you need to do X, Y, and Z to get it there, would get a lot more out there. I think the people that are actually publishing are people like Tony, who are a lot more organised and conscious. And then on the other end of the scale are the people that don't care. They just want to share the stuff they've made and they want to get it out there. And it's those two sort of scales, and the ones that just want to get their thing they've created out there don't quite care so much about, what standard of the documents they are. Here's what I've created, take it, do what you want, sort of thing.
So we need the International Make a Game Editing Guild, something
we
like
do
that.
I think so, yeah. Or just the sort of not publishing forum, but something that will just take them, help sort of shake it up a little bit, get it into a little bit of, it doesn't have to be perfect, but getting it into a better shape for them. And say, because like all those free ones, they're not really free. We look at that list of free mega games. What they really are is, like myself, they are some of the documents to give you a hint and a help in getting inspiration for what you might do. There's so much work people have done out there that's not shared. And, I think it's great that more stuff's published, like Tony's doing, that's great. But, I'm not going to spend $200 to buy Tony's product, because I'm probably not going to run it.
What?
I would absolutely love to have that money.
You should run it.
Maybe when I sell 5 versions of mine, I'll buy it, or we'll swap or something. But what I mean,
I'll trade your version.
Yeah, we'll trade versions. But what I mean is, I'm not going to get the insight to what you've done there and share that. And I hope there's somewhere in between a forum where we can share the experience so more people can get it out. But I do also think people need to be financially rewarded for the products they're making. I don't think things should be for free, but I think there must be somewhere where we can, like Tony, you're already doing it with your brilliant, bronze, silver, gold, sort of what I think should be in there. But the more bits we can share to help people would be great, not sharing for free whole products, but maybe we can share a sort of best practice of a few different ones. Here's a really good product list, here's a really good control guide from different ones, so that people can get some confidence in doing it themselves.
Definitely. I think more knowledge sharing in general would be amazing. And I think your idea of having a template for here's, fill this out to make the rules or documents or stuff for your mega game. Here's the kind of checklist of things you should be thinking about. I think that would be an incredibly useful tool. That's definitely something to look at.
Yeah, now someone has to do it.
Yeah, that's why someone else should do it. Someone listening to this podcast.
Looking at you, Tony.
we're looking at you, listeners. You know, do your part. but yeah, I'm more than happy to tweet Tony about, you know, what we've done, what we've got, sort of some good versions. Because I think stuff in the sort of free mega game and the design guides out there maybe could do with some more templates or ideas for people.
So, Tony, having been through this process and released the thing and all of that, is there anything you would do differently next time or change in future for a future game? Or do you feel like you had it pretty much nailed?
I need more people to run my game so I can see where my gaps are. As I've said before, it's like a living document. So, you know, this guide is not, it's not the be-all and end-all, and it needs to be fleshed out more. And I think there's arguments to be said whereabouts on the list these items should go, whether they're mandatory or not for a good quality product, or whether they're nice to haves. I don't know. And the more games that I run, the more insight I will get. I plan to be in this hobby for a long time yet, and so as I see other people's games and design my own, I'll be always learning. You know, we're talking here a lot about designing your own game and packaging it up, and about the benefits of doing that. And you should, you know, if you've got a good idea, you should design your own game. But I'm just gonna say this one more time, that there are so many amazing games already out there. Do not feel pressured to go ahead and write your own. I mean, when I heard on your podcast about It Belongs in a Museum, I thought, what a fantastic theme and what a fantastic game that probably is based on what I heard. And so that sort of encouraged me to reach out to the designers and get myself a copy of it. And so, you know, you listen to enough of these podcasts and you're online enough and you read in blogs and things like that, that you hear about amazing games. And so I would encourage you to reach out to these designers and find out like what status their games are in and encourage them to go through these steps themselves and help them with these steps. You don't have to be, you know, Zane was talking about different skill sets. If your skill set is not designing and you're more of an organizer and a planner, like I'm a project manager by trade, you know, that's what you bring to the table for someone who does not have those skills. So reach out to them, find out what these games are, and find out what they need so that you can put them on.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I find I have encountered a lot with people here and abroad who are just entering the hobby. And it's not so much that they feel obliged to make their own design, but they really want to. There's something about, you know, being able to jump in and say, I don't need other people's stuff. I understand what this mega game thing is. I want to create my own brand new thing, and it's going to be amazing. And I get that because that's probably how I started as well. But I think that the quality and the accessibility of published games is on the rise. So totally agree. I think we should be encouraging more people to start there.
I don't want to discourage anybody from designing a game, but just know that designing a mega game is really hard work. I mean, running somebody else's game is hard work, right? But designing your own game and making sure your components are up to snuff and all that stuff, it's just immense. It's a huge amount of work and it's exhausting. After I finish Gods, you know, I'm going to give myself a year of year off designing because I just can't go through that again. I want to run other people's amazing designs. And already I'm hearing about other designs that I'm like, oh, that's so good. I've got these ideas on the back burner, but these sound really good too. And so I'm kind of torn for next year. It'll probably be a combination of both, I imagine. But it's a lot of work to design and run a successful mega game. It really is.
I think if we look at the survey results, wasn't it, of how many games have you designed came through? You know, how many games have been designed versus how many are actually accessible?
Yeah.
I bet if you look at that, you know, how many of those are actually accessible for someone else to run. I imagine, I mean, obviously it's just guessing, it's a small percentage. And as you say, Tony, you know, if we could get, you know, even half of access to half of those out there, there are so many good, brilliant ideas that could be, even if you use them just to inspire your game, you know, I think, you know, we're in a creative industry where borrowing from each other is absolutely the way to do it. You know, no idea is original, really. You know, everyone's had most ideas in some form or another. At some point, there's probably something similar to what you're thinking about out there, and there's nothing wrong with trying to have a look at it and be inspired. But let's get more of those games out there and in a place where we can, other people can run them, definitely.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'd better start wrapping things up from there. I think thank you so much, Zane and Tony, for coming on. This has been a wonderful discussion, I think. I think I'll just ask if either of you have any final gems of insight or anything you'd like to say about the process of wrapping up, and any advice to anyone who is keen to get their game out there. Zane?
I guess don't be shy, just get it out there, you know. The community is great. You know, if it needs some work, as Tony said, the people will actually help you. So don't hide your game. Don't be worried about, you know, it not being quite up to scratch. I'd say just offer it. Let people know it's there.
Absolutely. And Tony?
Be organized. I'm going to shame all these people that stay up till 3 o'clock in the morning the night before. It drives me crazy. But seriously, like, the most important document to me when I am designing or running somebody else's is what I call a checklist. And it basically tells me how I organize a game so that it's ready to put on the table in front of someone on the day. So, for example, we'll just take Watch the Skies as a basic example, or any variant of it. You have... In my checklist, I've got a section that says for each nation, and then I've got a multiplier that says times 8 or 10 or however many nations you've got. And under that, I've got everything that goes on that table at the beginning of the game, either in a baggie or a manila envelope, and the quantity of everything. And so what this document does for you, so you've got for each nation, you've got 8 of those. You've got four aliens, what the aliens do and what they need. For alien control, what that person needs. For what the media control needs, etc., etc. And so by the end of it, you've got this one document that tells you what it takes to put on your game from a components perspective. And that on its own will check off most of these things on this list, because it tells you what the game looks like when it's ready. It tells you what you need. It tells you what you need to reprint after you've run it the first time, quantities. It tells you your cost, basically, because you can see all the components you need to create and how much documents you need to print off and how many print cartridges you need. So I think that checklist is the most important piece of documentation to have. Be organized.
I think summarizing that, we could probably say, as you are entering the exercise of designing a mega game and wanting to be able to have it a final product that you can hand out, every step of the way, ask yourself, what would Tony do?
Oh boy, that's dangerous.
Thank you both for coming and chatting to us about this. I think there's heaps for us to still to go through, and even before we started recording, we identified a few sort of adjacent things that we could probably discuss at another time for future episodes. But for now, I think that's a lot to consider. Where can people get in touch with you if they're keen to hear more about your rubric or more about the games that you're publishing now? Tony?
My website is dukesofhighland.net. Mm-hmm. And that is where you can read all about my design process, and you can read my blog, and you can sign up for my newsletter. I release an email newsletter at least once a month about the goings-on of what we're doing locally and at Gen Con. I'm also on the Discords and Facebook and all those places too.
And Zane, where can people...
I'm not, I'm not that organized. Stand in a field and shout my name loudly, and I'll come.
We managed to find you pretty easily every time we need to. So around the mega game traps.
Yeah. Put a shout out on any of the sort of Facebook groups, any of the Discord groups. I've usually got Zane in my name somewhere, or through Very Large Huge Games website, or through Diversionary Games website, which is still just about hanging on out there.
Perfect. And we will have links to all of those locations. If you want to get in touch with Zane and Tony, you can also come through us. And if you have any thoughts about publishing mega games, or even just the exercise of peer review and helping people get their designs ready for public consumption, we would love to hear from you. Thank you both again. Been a great chat, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me.